Welcome to the Intertidal Talks podcast. I am Kendra, marine biologist and your host. This podcast is meant to teach, inform, and entertain you about all things marine science and conservation. If you are a marine scientist or advocate with a story to share, you can contact me at intertidaltalks@gmail.com. Want to join our marine science community? Join us at patreon.com/kendi_marinebio. Welcome to Intertidal Talks. I have with me Francesca Trotman.
Close enough.
Okay. why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi. Thanks for having me on. My name is Francesca Trotman. I am the managing director and founder of an organization called Love the Oceans. That's kind of everything I do. That's my life. I live and breathe it. We're a marine conservation organization, so yeah, I love chatting about all things marine conservation.
Well, we do too. Where are you from, and like, what's your education background? Because one thing I like to share a lot about is everyone in this field's marine like education background, because it's very different, I feel like, for each person.
Definitely. I was quite lucky. So how I got into it, I guess I'd like always been obsessed with like sharks in the marine world. And then I did marine biology at university. And I went to University of Southampton and did their integrated masters, which was like the cheapest and the quickest way to do a master's. And so I then, I founded the organization while I was at uni. So it was kind of like, just kind of went from there. So my career path has been a lot more direct, and also just my CV is a lot emptier than a lot of my stuff. Like, all my stuff are crazy overqualified. And whenever I do careers talks, I'm always like, this is mine. And it's like nothing on there. It's just like university, Love the Oceans, and then a few qualifications within Love the Oceans. And then my staff are like, interned here and volunteered here and worked here. And they're all like amazing. And I'm just like, yep.
But founding something is super cool, and like the entrepreneurial spirit. I minored in entrepreneurship and I helped found a couple projects while in university, and I think it's great. I think it definitely shows a lot of initiative, and you're talking about this organization you founded. Do you want to share more about it? What is Love the Ocean?
Yeah, definitely. So I started LTO because I usually refer to Love the Oceans as just LTO because it's easier. But I started LTO when I was in my, I was in my master's year. So I went to Mozambique at the end of my second year on an internship. And that was when I saw my first shark killing. And like, I wanted to work out why the sharks were being killed, which was for the shark fin trade. And then I wanted to work out how bad the shark fin trade was. So then that's what I did like my master's on. And then I founded the organization off the back of doing my master's. So, like, I was writing up my results and I was getting the exact, like, what you would expect in terms of the sustainability of the shark fin trade, i.e. not sustainable. I then wanted to like, basically do something about it. It was like something that I felt like I couldn't just walk away from and like live the rest of my life like absolutely fine. So I decided that I wanted to take some action around it and like help stop it. So then I started Love the Oceans initially just to like tackle the shark fin trade, but then we expanded rapidly into like lots of different areas. And because I started in like the November and I was going to graduate, well, I graduated in the July. So I had like 8 months, whatever, of like thinking about what a successful conservation strategy looked like and planning basically how to run the organization. Mm-hmm. So gave up sleep and social life and finished my master's and started running the organization. And that's kind of like how we were born. Like, we didn't start everything that we do like all at the same time, but we started with like, I definitely started it with like the sharks in mind kind of thing. So initially, like, I think in my head our mission was to like stop the shark fin trade, but then the more I read into like successful conservation strategies, the more I realized that like we needed a multi-pronged approach, and you can't just tell people to stop fishing when people rely on it as a food source and financial source of income. So then I changed the mission to establishing a marine protected area in our region in Mozambique as a whole, because that encompassed like lots of different things and lots of different aspects, and also provided that like financial incentive in terms of like people being able to transition over to sustainable ecotourism rather than relying on shark fishing as a source of income. And then expanded our research quite rapidly over the years and our community outreach. So now we do fisheries research, humpback whales, coral reefs, ocean trash, whale sharks, manta rays and turtles. And then we run 3 community outreach projects. We teach basic marine resource management. And that's to 10 to 13 year olds. Then we teach swimming to 4 to 18 year olds. And then we do a sustainable fishing project with the active fishermen. And we actually have a 4th one as well, doing alternative livelihood plans, so like working out other, basically a lot of our work is like about identifying barriers that stand in people's way of living more sustainably and then working to remove those barriers. So like one of those was swimming, because 95% of people in our area can't swim. So being able to give people the opportunity to gain swimming skills meant that with the job creation in the MPA, like with the creation of the marine protected area, the job creation is going to be in the marine ecotourism space. So that means that people, to be able to utilize that, they're going to need to be able to swim to like lead snorkel tours and that kind of stuff. So that's kind of where the swimming came in. And that's the kind of attitude that we take with the alternative livelihoods. And the idea being that if you can provide people with an alternate source of income, then that alleviates the pressure off the oceans to provide financial and food security, and ultimately helps the marine environment. That was kind of a long-winded way of explaining it.
No, that was great. No, I love the conservation efforts that are doing more than just, especially with shark fishing, just promoting the end of shark fishing, but finding a solution for the shark fishermen. There's a couple of projects in Indonesia that I know about. Project Q is one of them, but there's also the Thresher Shark Project Indonesia. And both are finding ways that fishermen can stop fishing sharks, but still have an income. Because that's the thing, is they're not, don't think anyone thinks shark fishermen are just these evil people, but it's how they're providing for their families. And we can't just expect them to not do that, because like we have to find a way that they can still be supporting their families. And so I think that's amazing that you're doing this project.
I feel like
so many other things.
Yeah, I feel like the media sometimes, like if you don't work in this space, I know that when I was a kid, I definitely like viewed people who did the shark finning as like the baddies and the conservationists as like the goodies. And that's just so not what it's like. But I think like for the purposes of like gripping documentaries and stuff like that, a lot of the time the rhetoric is turned into goodies and baddies and who's going to win kind of thing, which is really like anti-community conservation. Like it really doesn't help. So we've definitely had like, we've worked with a few different documentary makers where I've had to take quite a hard line and been like, nope, we're not doing it that way, because that is not like how it is. But it's difficult because you want people to like get behind your cause. And we had this recently with a press release, and the like words that someone had used was like fight against shark finning. And it's just not like that anymore. Like I don't know if like it's just because now I work within the industry, or whether it's changing, but like I feel like people definitely realize that it's not about fighting, it's about working together and coming up with a solution, and education being a massive key component to that, and changing that kind of language is such an important part of that as well. But it's tricky, like swings and roundabouts.
Well, it's definitely an issue like I've seen a lot with people being really hateful towards people that fish in general, but also shark fishermen. I know there's a big thing about like xenophobia in the community of like conservation community. A lot of people are very quick to point blame at places like China and Japan for like their practices, especially with like the Taiji dolphin slaughter, and just outwardly accusing Japan of being terrible and boycott traveling to Japan and those terrible Japanese. But I think we all have a role to play in like issues like captivity. Is the industry is driven a lot of times by the Western world, so by like us here in America, kind of a thing. And the same goes for fishermen. Like a lot of shark depletion is shark finning, but also bycatch. So we can fight shark finning all we want, but if we're still just going out and eating sushi every day, like we're part of the problem. And that's like one thing I love about organizations that find a solution, not just outwardly banning something and kind of like just being aggressive towards these people, because like we'd feel angry if someone was getting rid of our livelihood as well.
Yeah, exactly. And it just comes down to a point of privilege, right? It comes down to pure luck where you're like born into. And like I'm sure if I was born into the exact same environment as the fishermen, I'd be doing the same thing. Literally, I think people kind of look at it and go, oh, I'd never do that, but like you would
if you were
born into that and didn't have like the knowledge or access to resources that like I've had, for instance. Like I've been incredibly privileged and lucky with like my education and stuff that has enabled me to do what I do, but like the fishermen that we work with haven't had any education around sustainability and haven't had access to that. So what are they meant to do? Like they're just trying to make a living and feed their family. And that's kind of why the alternative livelihood section is so important of what we do as well. Because it's just so difficult to navigate. Like we were working with the fishermen on a new project at the like second half of 2020. And it's about like transitioning the fishermen, or providing a way for the fishermen themselves to move from net fishing to kayak fishing, because according to our research over the last like 6 years, our fisheries research has shown that the net fishing is the least sustainable and the kayak fishing is the most sustainable in terms of the types of fish that are caught and the sizes. And one of the fishermen literally said, like, thanks so much for helping with this, because we've wanted to move away from net fishing for ages because we know it's bad, but we just haven't had the resources or access to resources before. And so this is allowing us to do what we want, which is great. And that's kind of like how I kind of think that NGOs should work, where you're facilitating the work that's already kind of going on the ground and it's all kind of locally led as well.
Yeah. And going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, the privilege, one thing that I watched a documentary about like just sustainable living, but one point in it is that we're so disconnected from like our food sources, especially when we are more privileged. We're not the ones going out, whether it's meat, milk, your seafood, like we're not out catching it. So a lot of times we don't even think about it. Like I grew up nowhere near the ocean. I didn't think about anything about if it's even bad to fish or certain kinds of fish until like I moved somewhere coastal and started pursuing like the marine science education. And then there's so many more nuances to that. Like there in the fishing industry, there's a huge human trafficking issue that a lot of people don't even know about. And that's something that a lot of us are trying to combat and bring awareness to get rid of that and then turn the whole fishery industry to be more sustainable.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. I was in I've just joined Clubhouse and I was in a room with someone yesterday who is like, his profession is not, so a lot of organizations like ours works from the bottom up, right? And then you get other organizations like Sea Shepherd and Greenpeace that work from the top down. But it's quite rare that people work in the middle. And there is obviously a middle section of people who are the people who are like actually smuggling the illegal traded, like the illegal, like animals or, you know, shark fins, rhino horns, that kind of stuff. And his work is identifying those people and like basically arresting them, because he was saying that, I can't remember what country it was and I really wish I could remember it, but he was saying that one of the groups that he's been working to like convict basically at the moment is because they smuggle shark fin out, but they smuggle humans as well in. So they're actually human traffickers as well as shark fin traders. And I think a lot of people don't realize the connection that lies there, because you're bribing officials to allow that to happen. And then they just use the same officials, but with bigger things like human trafficking, for instance, and they bribe those same officials to do other illegal activities. So most people, like a lot of people that are illegal traffickers in terms of like wildlife animal, like wildlife stuff, will also do other stuff as well that's illegal. So it's like a massive issue. And I remember watching a documentary a while ago. I think it was Racing Extinction, or one of the really big like major docos. And I remember them saying like the illegal wildlife trade is second in the world to the illegal drug trade. And I was just like, that is so nuts. Like, and no one talks about it. Like, it's just like the majority of people like living in cities away from the sea or who don't work in this kind of industry, they don't, it's not a day-to-day conversation. And it's just so nuts to think about, but yeah. Pretty crazy.
Yeah, it's like in human rights, like how you're saying the shark fin trade and human trafficking like can work hand in hand in a lot of areas. Like human rights is tied to a lot of times these, I'm not gonna say animal rights, but animal welfare issues, and animal conservation, wild animal conservation issues. We're all a part of the same ecosystem, and I think a lot of times when we're fighting against the shark fin, not fighting against shark fin trade, working with shark fishermen and trying to kind of, I guess, dismantle shark fishermen and create alternate incomes, we're also trying to help these issues of human trafficking and human rights.
Yeah, definitely.
Which I think is awesome. And so you mentioned that your organization does a lot of research. Can you talk a little bit more about the research you do? Any like specific studies that you guys have come out with that are super cool, or any current projects that you just want to share about?
Yeah, for sure. So everything we do kind of is because of our mission of establishing the marine protected area. So everything kind of always links back to that. So our for instance, our fisheries research is to look at the sustainability of different types of fishing, which obviously now, like, so all of our research informs conservation action. So that's now informed our sustainable fishing project that we launched with the fishermen last year. So our fisheries research is looking at the different types of fishing, what's most sustainable, what's least sustainable, what's being caught, what kind of bycatch is being caught, all of that kind of stuff. And then helping, like, that basically forms like the base that we then work with the fishermen on. Then our coral reef research is looking at the base level, like working out the base health of the reef. So none of the area that we work in has never been researched before. So all of our research is the first in the area of this kind. And that means that we do have to get baseline surveys to kind of understand what's going on before we can actually do anything. And so our coral reef research thus far, or like up to last year, I'd say, it was very much like gaining an understanding of what's going on in the area. And that's a continuous data set. So we are still doing that, but now we're at the point where we're able to form new hypotheses. So we know that like there's a imbalance in between the herbivores and the carnivores in the area on local reefs. So now we can form projects to address that. And we're just starting a new project with Leeds University that was meant to be launched last year, but obviously COVID. So that's been delayed, but that's looking at like recruitment rates and mortality of coral in the area too. And the kind of point of that is to be able to provide that evidence of this area would be better if we could protect it, like what that MPA protection would actually mean for the corals in the area too. And then we have our whale shark manta research and our humpback whale research. All is really, that's the financial incentive for the MPA, really, because what we're doing there is identification surveys, so building a database of individuals that visit the area. So our humpback whales are seasonal, but our whale sharks and our manta rays are residential. And what we're trying to do with that is basically prove, especially with the humpback whales, because we have so many whales in whale season, we're basically trying to prove that we can guarantee a tourist sighting of one of the like megafauna species that are like, I always call them like our sexy megafauna species, because they're always the like animals that, you know, Blue Planet and like the major docks use people to get like see. General public, yeah, enthused, yeah. Exactly, like people travel all over the world to see. And so that's like basically saying that because we can guarantee a tourist sighting of these animals, it's a very feasible ecotourism spot. So that's like the financial kind of incentive for establishing the MPA. And then within our humpback whale research as well, we actually do bioacoustic study as well, looking at song evolution and cultural transmission, which in itself is slightly different but pretty cool, and something I'm still on a very sharp learning curve on. And then we also have our ocean trash research, which is looking at the trash that's washing up on our shores, and there's a couple of splinter projects that we're working on at the moment, and I wanted to launch them in 2021, but I think it might be more 2022, depending on what happens with COVID. But one of them, so we, at the moment, what we do with our research with the ocean trash stuff is we collect everything that's on the beach, or as much as we can on the beach. Obviously, yeah, everything is a bit ambitious, but it's because there's just so much plastics, unfortunately. But we collect the trash that washes up on the beach, and then we have categories which we then log it into, so micro, macro plastics, toothbrushes, lollipop sticks, flip-flops, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then we weigh that as well, so and we also collect like 2 liter Coke bottles from the resorts in the area, that because people throw them away obviously after using them at the restaurants. And we pack all of the plastic into those bottles, and those bottles form bricks, in just a really basic form of eco bricks. And then we use them in local construction projects. So that helps, because we don't have, we're in a really rural area. There's no like roads or anything. It's all just sand. So there's no like, you know, garbage removal or recycling units or anything like that where we are. It's all, and you kind of have to deal with your own trash. And previously people have been like burning trash, but that is obviously presents its own heap of problems when you burn plastic. So that's where we are at the moment with our plastic stuff, that I'm actually hoping to expand a couple of projects. One will be taking samples up and down the coastline of Mozambique of the sand and working out the microplastic composition in the sand and possible sources. Like the main theory being that the river outlet from the main city is probably going to be, like the sand samples from around there is probably going to have a lot of microplastics in. And then the other project that we're looking at launching is a microplastics in the water column project. So that's basically towing essentially a zooplankton net by the side of the boat and collecting, it'll be surface seawater, and identifying the plastics in the water column just from that, using microscope basically, and then comparing that to the filter feeders, like how much we know, how many gallons of water we know the filter feeders are filtering every day, and then looking at how much microplastics those filter feeders, so our whale sharks and the manta rays, could be consuming just through suspended microplastics in the water column. So that's our plastics. And then we just started our turtles. Well, we've kind of like been doing turtle data for like 2 years, but this is probably, I'd say, like we properly started it now. In 2020, we launched our turtle team. And that is so we have turtle nesting from November to March in our area, and we have loggerheads and leatherbacks nesting. Mm-hmm. And leatherbacks actually have an elevated conservation status in our area. They're critically endangered, so they're like one step away from extinct in our area. And we have those two nesting on our beaches. So and unfortunately, especially with the rise of COVID, we've seen a lot more poaching, because people are just more desperate, right? Like they just need to eat, so they're just digging up nests and eating the eggs. And then also you've got like people that irresponsibly drive on the beach and all of that kind of stuff too. So what we do now is we post guards on every nest, and that's we have a turtle patrol team that walks every morning and finds the new nests, and then they post guards, and those guards work like 8-hour shifts, and there's 3 guards per nest, so 24-hour like care of the nest essentially, and that's to ensure, that's from laying to hatching, so that's to ensure that there's someone there basically to make sure it's not poached the whole time. So that's our turtle area of research, and we're also expanding the turtle research next year to include identification of like turtles alive in situ, like swimming around in the ocean. to build a database on them as well. But I think that's all about research in a nutshell. I think we do quite a lot, so it's quite difficult to remember sometimes. But
I will say that's incredible. You have your fingers in like every pie. but the note about COVID, I wanted to ask, like, how have you seen COVID impacting your organization, maybe your researchers, but again, also the local community? Like, as you're saying, you are kind of seeing maybe more issues with the leatherback sea turtles. Is that happening with any other species?
Yeah, definitely. So as an organization, we've had to completely pivot on our like source of income, and now we're like pretty much completely dependent on donations to see us through this section. Before we were running like projects where people could come and get involved, and it was like an ecotourism type thing, and that all funded our research. But like pretty much all of the scientific grants now, and any grant, to be honest, is like, this must go ahead. Despite COVID, like, they all put a caption in there, which means you can't apply for the grants anymore. If you think you could by any chance get delayed. So the grants have like completely gone out the window. Our ecotourism has completely gone out the window because of travel, so we've had to pivot completely, and now we're just reliant on donations. So a lot of my work is like phone calls with businesses being like, please give us money. On the ground, we've seen, and it was actually the reason that we launched our sustainable fishing project when we did, because that was a project that we'd wanted to do for a while, and we knew it would be great, but we just hadn't, like, we just the I think our like planned start date for it was 2022, but before COVID became a thing. And then when COVID started properly locking the world down, like last March, Moz locked its borders from March to October, and that within that time they also banned all but essential activities. So locking its borders meant obviously the tourism industry just friggin' collapsed, like there was no tourism whatsoever. And then also all but essential activities meant that everyone was essentially starving. Like, the thing is that in developing countries, it's been obviously really challenging, but we live in countries that were very fortunate where the government have to provide a level of like care, at least, like benefits or whatever. And there is like some free resources to fall back on, but in Mozambique, there is literally nothing. So the government shut everything down, and then it was like everyone, every man for himself kind of thing. And so we saw a mass increase in net use in the area, because netting is such an easy way of fishing, because you just put a net in and leave it and then fish swim into it. Whereas obviously pole and line, it requires a bit more skill and equipment. Netting, people can use mosquito nets for their fishing nets, like, and they catch literally everything, because obviously mosquito net gill, like the mesh size is tiny. So it's super unsustainable. So we just saw like this massive increase in people just becoming more desperate, and it was like really sad to see, because like there are like friends, like that's people I work with and I know on a day-to-day basis, but also just like sad for the marine life as well, because you're just seeing everything get decimated. But at the same time, you're like, I kind of understand why it's happening, because if I was in their position, I'd be doing the exact same. Like, if it's your family or like wildlife, you're going to choose your family when it comes down to like life and death situation. So it was really tricky seeing it happen, and we were like, okay, we need to come up with something here, we need to do something which is going to be a win for everyone. So we're kind of racking our brains, and Andrea, our executive director, she came up with moving the sustainable fishing project forward, and we hadn't fully thought out what that was going to be before. So she like hashed out what it could be, and we worked together on the full kind of implementation of that. And that was basically us going, what can be a win for the sea and a win for people? And what can we do now that is going to help people right now? So that's kind of where the switching people to kayak fishing, enabling people to still fish, but then LTO being like our kind of like the NGO that we are, means that we have our charity status, so we can secure donations and stuff for the project too. But it also means we can do sustainability workshops and run things like that, like the educational side of things too. So the fishermen go through a sustainability workshop with us. They when they sign on to the initiative, they get full access to the kayaks and the pole and line equipment, all of that kind of stuff. They get methods training, so if they haven't used a kayak before and they need like help on how to launch and land like safely and all that kind of stuff, they get a methods workshop. But they give up their current method of fishing, so they switch out completely. So the idea being that people sign on, they ditch their nets, they have to give their nets to us, they start kayak fishing instead. And kayak fishing, even without sustainability workshop, our research shows that kayak fishing is just more sustainable because it's so much more selective, but also the type, because you're fishing rod and line and your hook is generally in pelagic waters, you're targeting carnivorous species. So it's actually like way more sustainable than like net fishing, which gets a lot of herbivores because you're dumping a net on a reef and then anything that swims into it. And generally herbivores are like the residential species on the reef. That's less sustainable. So we launched that because we spoke to Jemo, who's like the chief fisherman, and he spearheaded the project because we started chatting and he was really keen for it. And he was like, yeah, definitely, like this can help. And Pascal, our community outreach manager, he is just an amazing human. And he spearheaded that with Jemo, and it's been, yeah, really great. And it was just kind of like our way of trying to think of a win for everybody involved. And yeah, I think COVID has impacted Mozambique hugely. Because for instance, just to give you an idea, like there's 70% unemployment rate in our area. So loads of people are reliant on subsistence farming and fishing anyways. And the 30% that are employed were employed in the tourism sector. And generally in Mozambique, you have large families and you have a lot of dependents. So that 30% that was employed in the tourism sector support a lot of like kids and wives and husbands and brothers and, you know, everyone. And that, so cutting that out, COVID cut that 30% out completely, like tourism dropped that. That meant that basically everyone was unemployed in our area. And that means that people are just becoming more desperate. So they're just becoming more reliant on natural resources. I spoke to a project over in Indonesia a few months ago, and they were saying the exact same, like people want to live more sustainably, but they literally just don't have an option. So unfortunately it's led to more unsustainable practices when it comes to exploiting natural resources.
Yeah. And it's so sad, but that's why it's so great to have amazing organizations that are doing all they can to help the ecosystem and help the people. So amid COVID, how are ways that we as listeners can help you, either funding, getting involved? What are all the different ways during COVID and maybe after COVID that people can get involved and help your organization?
Right now, donations are super useful. That is like our entire income. So if anyone can donate, that's great. We have like, instead of just like, obviously you can just donate on the website and that is great. But if you don't want to just donate, we do have like initiatives where you kind of get something back a little bit. So you can adopt like one of our turtle nests. So we worked out the cost of employing the three guards for the whole like duration, you can adopt a turtle nest where you get like all the information about the turtle nests and like all the information about the specific guards, because obviously it's people that we work with on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. You get like a little video of your nest and things like that. It's really cute, and you get updates.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's quite expensive because obviously it is like three guards like 24 mm-hmm. hours a day for like 60 days. But we then offer the opportunity, because it's a bit more expensive, we offer opportunity for people just to sponsor an individual guard. So we have like all the guards listed on our website, and you can just choose one person. It's got a little bit of information about them. Obviously the guards are like totally okay with it, and we chatted with everyone and said like, are you okay with us fundraising this way? And so that's an option. You can also adopt a whale shark on our website, which is a fun one, because we have different whale sharks with different names. And then we have our exhibitions, which people can book onto, and that's probably a post-COVID thing. I really want it to run in 2021, but obviously we'll see what happens with COVID, which is impossible to predict at the moment. I would like to run some expeditions in 2021, but obviously it will definitely be back on in 2022. And that's if you want to come out and get your hands dirty and get involved in what we do, then you can get stuck in that way too.
Yeah, do you do interns or volunteers at all for like students?
Yeah. So we take interns and volunteers actually, and we take students as well that are, if you're like studying marine bio or something related at uni and you want to do your dissertation on a subject area that we work in, then people come out and do their dissertations with us too. So we're partnered with Liverpool University, Leeds and Newcastle in the UK on those projects, but you can come independently, you don't have to come through your university. So yeah, if there's anyone that wants to do that, then they can do that with us too.
That's super cool. I did want to ask, I feel like I saw a news article in the last few months about that area being an MPA, I can't say it. Mozambique? Is it Mozambique?
Whereabouts?
I don't remember. I think I like shared it because it was a good initiative. I have it linked somewhere nearby.
So we're just about to launch a hope spot in our area, which is basically like that's Sylvia Earle's organization,
yeah. Mission.
Yeah, and that's what we're going to launch.
That might be what it was.
Which is super exciting. Our nearest national parks are Ponta de Aura, which is a partial marine reserve down south, and Pomine, which is further up north, and Bazaruto, which is a little bit further north again. So our kind of pitch when it comes to the MPA proposal is that we're in the middle of that corridor. So we have migratory humpback whale species and things like that. Coming through, so we're forming that like middle ground in the south of Mozambique, and so like our area is important to protect, but the kind of idea that we're going with is that it's locally managed. We're the NGO partner working with the community to establish a marine protected area, and the idea being that that should take less resources off the government, so we're kind of hopeful that the government will be a bit more pro it and be like, yeah, this is a good idea, because we're not going to be asking for like them to fund rangers and things like that, because that's like our job as the partner NGO. We can secure funding for that and help with that kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, watch this space. Hopefully we'll have the MPA established in the next, like, we're hoping 3 to 5 years. Obviously it depends what happens with COVID and general global pandemics like going forward. we're really hopeful that this will happen in the next 3 to 5 years. So it's exciting times.
Yeah, I'll correct myself. It was an article by Oceanographic is what I saw, and it's manta rays and whale sharks now protected by new commercial fishing laws. That's what
So that was a law that passed in that had actually been in the works for a really long time. And it was just pushed through recently. And that was in October. The article was actually published in the Mozambique Bulletin, and then it came into like law effect. It comes into effect 90 days after the bulletin's published, which brought it through to like January. So I think a lot of people were talking about it in January.
Yeah.
But it protects a bunch of different animals. So like seahorses are protected, humpback whales, all the sea turtles. Unfortunately, it's difficult because like, the law changing and the practical side of it are two different things, which is why like we have our sea turtle project, because technically it is illegal to poach the sea turtles, but then are people still doing it? Yep. So it's kind of like the practical side of making sure that that works as well, and how that's translated. Like I sent a copy of that legislation actually to Gemmo, the chief fisherman in our area, just to be like, heads up. And unfortunately, a lot of people just don't even get access to a copy of the bulletin. So it's difficult to actually have that, like how it translates down into action on the ground is quite different. Yeah. But it obviously is a great step in the right direction, definitely.
So, to wrap up, thank you so much, first of all. This has been great. But what kind of tips do you have for aspiring marine scientists, conservationists, researchers, and even entrepreneurs, since you very clearly have an amazing entrepreneurial spirit?
Thanks. Tips. Resilience, because you're gonna get told a trillion times, especially as a woman, working in this industry that you can't do what you're going to do. So I've literally had so many people, my biology teacher at school included, say that I couldn't do it. I mean, obviously I hadn't formed the idea of Love the Oceans back in school, but he
didn't was help
me at all. You will have a few along the way that really get behind you. Like, I was really lucky at university. I had a supervisor that was very supportive, Ken Collins at University of Southampton, who's always just been great. And when you get those people, hang on to them for dear life, because they're going to be useful people in your life. So resilience, I would say, is key, and just keeping going, because everyone that I know that's been successful in this industry has literally just kept going when other people have given up. So you've just got to keep going, which sucks sometimes because this industry financially is extremely difficult. So it often requires having another job and then doing it on the side. And that's extremely common. So kind of expect to do that. So don't be disappointed when that happens, because you're just probably going to have to do that. And that's, and know that that's not unusual. And that doesn't mean you're a failure in any shape or form. So resilience, I would say passion. Like, you've got to make sure that you definitely want to do it, because it's really difficult. So if you're not 100% sold on it, probably don't try to begin with, because you're not going to do it if you're not 100% obsessed. I think those two would be my biggest, resilience and passion would be my two biggest tips, which seem a bit airy fairy, but I do really think that they're really important when it comes to doing this. Like, I guess drive and, like, I say single-mindedness. My friends say I should never say that, because apparently single-mindedness has negative connotations, but I'm definitely obsessed with my work, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
I agree.
Yeah.
But you think resilience and passion is perfect. Like, I get comments all the time about, oh, there's no money, what's the point? And that's where I'm like, that's kind of what separates, I feel like, the people out of this industry, is it is more about your passion. Sadly, it's not funded the best, especially from NGO work. It is on a grant by grant basis a lot of the times, unless you're kind of bigger and you get massive funding. But especially with COVID going on, a lot of our projects have been completely halted or postponed, which is just keeping a lot of us from making an income. And then COVID keeps, like, you're gonna have a side job. That's what happens. Even like people pursuing a master's, like, you can be having your master's in marine science, but working at a cafe on the side while you do like lab work. And sometimes your lab works just volunteer because they can't afford to pay you for, or whatever. Like, it's okay. Yeah. That's 100%. I feel like most of us have gone through that.
Yeah. Like, everyone that I know that works in this industry, like, we run a little Instagram Q&A session and I have different people on, and everyone's conservationists, and literally everyone has multiple job titles. It's never like one thing. It's like they do this and they do this and they do this and they do this and they do this, because not one pays the bills. They have to do like five different things to pay the bills.
Exactly.
So it's really, and half the time people are like, yeah, I do this when I can, and that's my proper passion, but then I also have to do like this thing, which I'm not so crazy about, but yeah, I gotta eat. So, and even now, like, I've been running the organization 6 years, and yes, I am full-time with Love the Oceans. And I do get paid a very small wage that's enough to pay me when I live in England, like when I'm in England, which I'm here for like 3 or 4 months a year. So as an organization, that kind of works for us, because I only have to be paid for 3 or 4 months a year, because then I'm in Mozambique where living costs are crazy low. I still work as an underwater photographer for some of my work, and I sell my photos and I get paid that way too. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't go into the industry expecting you're going to be rich. Go into it because you love it.
Yep. I mean, I hope that's what people do any industry, but I don't know. That's, I've never thought about pay. I love that. I freelance on the side. Like, I feel like that's a huge part of it. And that's all of your photography. That's amazing. I can put that in the description if you send me links to that. Awesome. Thank you so much. Everything, like all kinds of links for donations, everything we talked about will be in the description for everyone listening. So it's easy for you to find it, easy to donate, easy to support, because this work is obviously so crucial and incredible. And I would love for people to donate. If I made any kind of money on the podcast, I would donate the funds from this episode, but I don't. This is just kind of what I do for fun, to spread more awareness. Maybe one day it will maybe make something that I can then donate, because
we definitely appreciate the support. So thank you so much for having me on. It's been so lovely chatting to you. It's always great to talk to like-minded people.
It's so fun, and I love learning about like different things in different areas, because I feel like a lot of times I was in Hawaii and I was very centric on what was happening in Hawaii, and then now I've expounded. Obviously I know a lot about some projects in Indonesia, and then I'm in Canada, so I kind of know about different things happening up here, but there's the ocean is vast and covers 70% of our planet, so obviously there are projects happening everywhere that we can't be aware of at all times, and so I love being able to help give a voice to the different projects.
It's so awesome to be on here. Thanks so much.
Thank you.